This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine, the consumer resource of pilots and aircraft owners.
Hi, this is Mary Grady for AvWeb, and today I'm talking with Rick Gillespie, the executive director of TIGER, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. The group is best known for their work exploring a remote Pacific island where they think Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan might have landed after they went missing in 1937. TIGER has been trying to extract DNA from some materials found on the island. Here's Rick with an update.
We have some human DNA that has been found in material that we've been suspecting is human fecal material. Now, we don't know whether it's Earhart's DNA, obviously. We don't have enough of the DNA yet to sequence or compare to the Earhart family reference sample that we have. TIGER, in cooperation with the molecular anthropology laboratories at the University of Oklahoma, we've been trying to see if we could get DNA from some bone fragments that we have reason to believe may be human. There were some initial indications of human DNA, and then they couldn't get any further human DNA. So we don't know yet what the answer there is. We can't make any definitive statements about it. It still may be a human bone, but there's so little of it left. You know, this extracting of attempts to extract DNA is necessarily destructive. What you do is you cut off a little piece of the bone and then you reduce it to a powder and then you treat it with various solutions and things. So it's a destructive process, and we're down to a small enough amount of bone so that we could make another try for human DNA to see if we could get enough to sequence. And even if we were successful, and even if that sequence matched the Earhart sample, we wouldn't have any left for an independent lab to evaluate. And if you can't get independent replication of your results, you've got nothing. So rather than do that, we're going to hold off and wait for the technology to get better, which it is doing almost daily, to where we can get better samples with a less destructive process. So we're going to hold off for further on that. That has to remain a mystery for the moment. But we do have DNA from what appears to be fecal material. And it's human DNA. There are two sequences there, which is really surprising. We don't have an explanation for that. There are several ways that two sequences of DNA can get into the same fecal material, but we don't know what the explanation is. So we're going to go to the next level of sophistication in testing. Rather than just look for human DNA in this stuff, we're going to get sequences for all the DNA that's there, all the bacteria, the plant, animal, whatever's there, and we're going to get tens of thousands of sequences. And then we're going to compare those to existing databases and start to identify that, well, this thing contains this, and it contains this, and it contains this. If it is fecal material, which it appears to be, we'll know something about what this person had been eating, what their state of health was, for example. We already know that there is an unusually high level of iron in this stuff. That could be blood. We know somebody died on this site, and if this is fecal material from somebody who died there, they were in pretty bad shape when they died, and it wouldn't be surprising to find blood in the fecal material. But, we'll be able to know a lot more once we do this process. It's called massively parallel sequencing. We're also going to do scanning electron microscopy and mass spectrometry. We're going to get a lot more information from this stuff. So this is all stages in the investigation. This kind of thing is fairly standard. You know, you test hypotheses, you get some information, you're frustrated on other information. It's a process, not an event. But We're generally encouraged that, first of all, we're getting no discouraging information. There's no bad news here. For example, if they had tested the bone, they got clear human DNA, and it didn't match either Earhart or Noonan, we'd say, oh, well, geez, whoever that was that died on the island couldn't have been Fred or Amelia. So there's nothing like that. We're still moving along the path toward what we hope will be a positive resolution.
Okay, so I have a couple of questions. One on the fecal
sure.
material that you found. Have you been able to date that? Is there some way to date that to the time that that Amelia
no.
went missing?
No, there's no way to date it. You can date stuff that was once alive by carbon dating, carbon-14 dating, but the parameters are quite broad. We could do carbon-14 testing on this stuff and date it to within about 75 years. Well, that doesn't help us a whole lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, no, there's no way to doubt it, to date it. What is odd is that it survived at all. How did it get hard and dry enough to survive being washed away by the next rain squall? That's another thing we don't understand about this stuff. Normally, fecal material on that island, as is everywhere else, goes away pretty quick. This stuff turned into what is archaeologically known as coprolite. It got hard and dry and was preserved. Now, they've gotten ancient DNA out of coprolites going back to Neolithic times, tens of thousands of years old. So it's not inconceivable that there would be ancient DNA in this stuff, which is almost certainly much more recent. But it's tough. DNA likes cold and dry. That's the conditions under which it's preserved best. And there's just not a lot of cold and dry on that island. That island is hot and wet. And so we're pushing the limits of the technology. But that's part of what makes it fun. This is a very, very difficult investigation, trying to tease information out of stuff that's badly deteriorated and this small. But that's what it's all about. It's seeing what we can learn. And at least for me, it's just fascinating.
Okay, so if you did find some identifiable DNA out of any of this material that you found, do you have enough information, enough data on Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan that you could determine that it belonged to them?
Well, I think it's important to define the limits of what we could possibly know. First of all, we're dealing here with mitochondrial DNA, which is not the kind of DNA you use to convict somebody of murder. Mitochondrial DNA is not unique to a particular individual. It is unique to a degree in a family. Your mitochondrial DNA is almost improbably identical to your mother's and her sister's and so forth. It's passed in the female line. Men can't pass it on. My mitochondrial DNA is the same as my mother's, not my father's. So if we get a match to DNA from the island to the mitochondrial DNA we have, the sample we have from a living Earhart relative in the female line, what it will technically tell us is that somebody directly related to Amelia Earhart in the female Earhart line died on that island. Well, yeah, okay. It's probably Amelia Earhart. Fred Noonan is a different problem. We have not been able to find a living relative in Fred's direct female line. And we have tried. We've had professional genealogists working on this. And so far, it's been a dead end. He was an only child. His mother had one sister who doesn't seem to have had any children. So we have to go back another generation, and that traces the family back to England, and it gets really tricky. So far, we do not have a sample for Noonan. And there's a plan B for that. If we absolutely have to go that route, it's a route we wouldn't want to go unless we had to. But we know where Fred's mother is buried. She's buried in Chicago. And if we can get a court order to exhume that grave and get DNA from his mother, then, we could we could get a sample that way. But that's obviously a last resort, and we would have to have DNA profiled that we had good reason to think might be Fred's before we would consider something like that.
So I understand you're going back there again next year to the Pacific Island to do some more research. And what is your strategy? What do you plan to do on that trip next year?
We, on the most recent trip in May and June of last year, we were able to do some searching with a remote-operated vehicle and get, for the first time, some accurate information about what the underwater environment is off the west end of the island, where all the evidence that we have points to the airplane having gone over the edge of the reef and down into the deep water there. The reef slope of the atoll turns out to be much steeper than anyone imagined. If you took the water away from this island, it would look like a mesa out west. You know, it just drops until about 1,000 feet, and then it really starts to level off. Anything that goes off the edge of the reef is going to go down the hill until the slope shallows out at about 1,000 feet down. Well, we didn't know that. Nobody knew that. And we only had the capability of searching down to about 1,000 feet. So as it turns out, we need to start searching at an area where we had to leave off searching last time. So we will go with the capability of going down much deeper, probably to at least 3,000 feet, and we'll search the whole west side of the island where the information we have, all the evidence from several sources, suggests that the airplane went over the edge, broke up in the surf, and there should be fairly large chunks of wreckage, engines, center section, laying on the bottom. And if it's down that deep, down below 1,000 feet, it's in the dark. It's beyond the reach of most of the sunlight. That means we'll have minimal coral growth down there, obscuring the wreckage. And that's good. So we'll see what we find. That's all we can do.
Okay, thanks, Rick. For more information about Tiger and what they're up to, you can visit their website at tigar.com. And this is Mary Grady for AvWeb. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine. For more information on Aviation Consumer, log on to www.aviationconsumer.com.